System. Alisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this Worldview Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and so glad to be with you today. Extra glad to be with you today because, as you may be able to hear a little bit in my voice, for the last couple of days, I haven't had a voice. I preached this sermon at our morning worship service on Sunday. Everything was just fine. And, well, a little bit towards the end of the sermon, I guess I got going a little bit maybe. But all of a sudden, you know, I just started to feel that my voice was a little bit questionable. I preach again at the evening service, so I do the Sunday school, the morning worship service, and then the evening service on Sunday. And so by the time the evening service made its way around, I basically had little voice at all. I was over there at Shepherd's Care with the folks. It's Shepherd's Care's assisted living facility. That's where we hold our evening service. So it's kind of important that I'm able to speak and speak loudly because many of them have hearing aids and, you know, their hearing is kind of compromised. And so I had to use a microphone there that night. And as I was preaching, I made it through that message. And actually, my voice got a little bit better as it went along. By Monday morning, my voice was completely gone. I couldn't say anything. And so yesterday, I shot Gary Miller over here, the producer of the program at Christian Talk here. I emailed saying that just can't do it. I've got nothing. So he went ahead and re-aired our broadcast from last Thursday. And so I'm just glad to be talking at all. I know that me being without a voice may be actually answering the prayers of many, but their prayers now have failed them because I'm back and the voice is somewhat back. So I'm just glad to be back in the studio with you. You know what I noticed with my voice being gone yesterday? Boy, was there an increase in the activity from my account on social media. The poor folks that follow me on Facebook and Twitter, you know, I was going to get out something one way or the other, right? And if I couldn't talk, it was going to come out in Facebook posts. And so I posted about everything yesterday. I just couldn't hold it in any longer. And so I apologize for for the people on those accounts. Well, today I don't have to do much of the speaking because we brought in our special guest, Edward Lee Pitts, is joining us here for the first part of the broadcast today. And he's going to talk to us about the issue of immigration. He has just wrote about this, and he wrote an excellent article summarizing what's taking place. So I'm going to let him do the majority of the talking here during the first part of the program today. On the second part of the program, I'm going to take a little bit of a break because when I couldn't talk so much the last couple of days, I was listening to a number of other programs. Maybe I should do that more often. But I was listening to a program that's carried right here on Christian Talk 660 on Sunday at 1:30. It's the Breakpoint program with John Stone Street. And I was listening to an interview that John did with an author that I wanted you to hear. It talks about technology, and I want you to hear what John, he did an excellent job on the interview. I want you to hear what they talked about that issue and what technology is doing to us. Very interesting, and so I'm going to play a portion of that on the second half of the program today. With that, Edward Lee Pitts, welcome back into the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Edward, you got a little bit of a hard act to follow because Warren Cole Smith was on the morning program this morning with Tony Beam, and so they were talking about a number of issues. I think their primary issue there this morning was what is taking place with the Boy Scouts of America, and I certainly hope that there's enough of an outpouring of disappointment that the Boy Scouts are even considering allowing gays to be leaders in their ranks there. I hope there's such an outpouring of people writing into them and contacting them saying that how much they're against this, that doesn't actually happen. It seems that they're kind of floating that idea. But anyways, Warren was on, did an excellent job this morning. I wanted to ask you about this issue of immigration, and specifically with Marco Rubio's role in this. I had an opportunity to interview Marco Rubio last year on the program, and maybe we'll find some of that audio and work it in here over the next couple of days. But tell us a little bit about what's taking place in this bipartisan immigration push.
Sure. It's come together rather quickly. I guess a lot of people here on Capitol Hill are speculating that the Republicans, post-election, looking at the numbers of the November election and how the Hispanic vote broke largely for Democrats and the margins gained over 4 years ago in 2008 when Obama first ran, that some of the Republicans seem to be more open to relooking at immigration. And so we have what we on Capitol Hill like to call gangs. Anytime Democrats or Republicans get together, they call it a gang. And this is a gang of eight, and they've come together and introduced a set of immigration reform proposals that includes both a pathway to citizenship for the estimated 11 million illegal immigrants who are already in the country, and they hope to pass the legislation as early as late spring. Now, as you know, a lot of conservative lawmakers oppose a pathway to citizenship for the illegal immigrants because they feel like that rewards illegal behavior or even doesn't punish them for breaking the law. So that's kind of the sticking point for a lot of conservatives.
Yeah, let me jump in there just 1 second, not only with my voice having trouble, but the connection with you. We're getting a lot of feedback or static on the line as well. So maybe, I don't know if you can move to a slightly different location, it might be a little bit better. But let me comment on something you said there and then get your comment on it. Do you think that this premise, you know, the premise of starting a lot of this, especially among the Republicans, is a proper premise to, you know, have as a foundation to start this discussion? The premise being this, that in the recent election that Hispanics went for Obama, what I mean by that is that there's a lot of reasons why they went for Obama, I think we need to be a little bit careful about now, you know, trying to give away the store, trying to match the Obama administration on trying to give away all these things to minorities, and in this particular case, legal and illegal immigrants, just because we happen to lose an election. I think that there are a lot of components as to why we lost the election, one of them being we didn't have a strong enough conservative candidate. And so I just want to get your comment on that. Do we have to be careful that we don't overreact here to the loss of the election?
Well, that's a point that a lot of conservative lawmakers have made here on the Hill since the immigration proposal was introduced on Monday. A lot of lawmakers say that Hispanics polls and exit polls and post-election polls that came out in November, a lot of the Hispanics did not list, surprisingly, immigration as one of their top priorities. So a lot of conservatives are wondering, why are we if we're only doing this because to get the Hispanic vote, then we're not paying attention to the exit polls, which show that a lot of Hispanics, that this wasn't at the top of their list for why they voted the way they voted, and there's other things to look at. So, yeah, that's definitely something being argued about. Now, this is a bipartisan deal with four Republican senators and four Senate Democrats. So the real question is how the Republican-led House is going to act and how they're going to treat this proposal.
Mm-hmm.
I know that John McCain on Monday, one of the bipartisan senators on this immigration deal, compared the new legislation to one immigration bill once authored by late liberal icon Ted Kennedy. And so, you know, using Ted Kennedy's name and talking to this bill or comparing this bill to something Ted Kennedy did is probably not going to help this deal's chances in the Republican-led House. And the New Deal also tries to make itself more appetizing to conservatives by calling the pathway to citizenship legalization rather than amnesty. But, of course, several conservative lawmakers in the House released statements after the immigration proposal was unveiled saying that legalization is still amnesty, and they're opposed to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know what McCain is thinking. You know, when he uses Ted Kennedy's words, just using McCain's name now is synonymous with moderate, and you know, it's he lost the election before that, and part of the reason that he lost the election before this recent one was because of that overly moderate stance on so many things. So right away, when we talk about this Gang of Eight, and we talk about four Democratic senators, and by the way, one of them being Schumer as well. We're not just talking about a low-level senator or something. You know, here's a very powerful, very liberal senator in Senator Schumer. And so we have to, right away, this red flags go up all over the place. And I myself, when I first heard it, you know, was like, oh, no, now Rubio has sold out on this as well. But my view has changed as I listened to him articulate better what the reason why he's involved, and that this is just a set of principles here to start with. It's just a framework, and that he is saying repeatedly that if they don't meet these principles that they've signed on to, then he's out. And so I do think from that standpoint, it is a good thing. And I think that he is a little bit better than most conservative senators or GOP conservatives at articulating this particular issue than many of the other ones are. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think those are great points. One thing to consider is that, like you said, this is not a detailed bill. It's just a proposal. I think it's like four or five pages of just outlining their priorities and their goals. And I think it's from a conservative perspective, it's important to have a seat at that table as this proposal outline gets written into hard, detailed legislation. So I think that the fact that Marco Rubio is there gives the conservatives a seat at the table, and we'll see, you know, what kind of influence he has on actually crafting this legislation. I know that Obama yesterday went and spoke at in Las Vegas, asking the senators to go forward and draft the legislation. I know that he's kind of holding back on his legislation because he wants to see what the senators do. But from everything I'm hearing, the White House's base immigration reform legislation would be even more liberal than the Senate draft right now. The House, meanwhile, is working on their own bill. Boehner announced that the bipartisan group of House members have been working on a bill for months, apparently, in secret, and are going to unveil their proposals, too. And it'll be interesting to compare the Senate bill outline with the House outline, with the White House outline, and kind of see where it all falls. But I think the two key factors for your listeners for this immigration debate is to watch what goes on in the House and see how they both react to the Senate bill, as well as what kind of details and proposals are in the House bill when it's released. And also the second thing for your listeners to pay attention to in all this is what Marco Rubio does. It's definitely a key moment for Marco Rubio, not just in his tenure as a senator, but also in his ambitions for 2016 and beyond as far as the White House and the presidency. And he's kind of stepping up. This is going to be a high visual thing, both because of the issue of immigration and also because he is a Cuban-American descent. So this will be kind of his make-or-break moment as a senator and potential presidential candidate.
Yes, when I spoke with him in person late last year, we talked about this a little bit, and he had a great line. His great line was that, this isn't something that he has read about in a book. This is something that he has lived himself. This is something that he has experienced. You know, his family is from Cuba, and having immigrated here and so forth, he really, I think, is one of the best spokespersons on this issue. He does have his finger on the pulse, and he speaks from personal experience, which is very powerful. I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned the fact that the president spoke yesterday. I was watching a lot of the coverage on that that speech, and it was very interesting. There were people that were saying, oh, no, you know, the president basically is going to destroy this thing before it even gets started by coming out with his own plan right away, even though they've now got some basic agreement here between four Democrats and four Republican senators. And so there was a lot of speculation as to what is he doing. Is he just trying to get out here and claim credit for what's taking place? You know, all of these types of things that both liberal and conservative media outlets were talking about yesterday, and what would the president's speech do to this issue. What was your take on it, and what sort of ramifications did it have on this issue?
Yeah, good question. I think that the feeling here in Washington, D.C. is that Obama wants to make immigration the issue of his second term, or at least the first 2 years of his second term, in much the same way he made health care his issue to push and his issue of choice is during his first term. I'm sure he probably doesn't want immigration to take as long as health care did, but there is some concern among people on the Hill, both Democrats and Republicans. I think that's interesting and important to note, but Democrats as well are worried about the Obama visibility on this and how much he's going to push himself out front. As a matter of fact, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus urged Obama to not unveil any specific legislation as long as the Senate and the House are doing their own bills, because they were afraid that that would just kind of muddy the water. So even people in his own party, some of the Senate Democrats, are hesitant to have him, unveil a bill and unleash a bill. Whatever Obama does do policy-wise is going to be much more permissive, much more left-leaning than even the Democrat Senate proposal that came out on Monday. And the ultimate thing to watch, if this goes on legislatively, is if Obama decides to do any executive orders. You know, that's one of his favorite tools the last few years, is to kind of bypass Congress and by an executive order, you know, pass some policy or pass some initiative that can't get through Congress. And he did that already with immigration last year with the DREAM Act, which allows an easier pathway to citizenship for young kids of illegal immigrant families who make certain grades in their coursework. And that's been real controversial. Wasn't able to pass Congress and because of a conservative opposition. And then Obama, right in the heat of the campaign last year, basically as an executive order, implemented a version of that DREAM Act, allowing a pathway to citizenship to children of illegal immigrants who are good students. And that was seen as, you know, a ploy on his part to kind of cater to the Hispanic vote heading into the election. And I wonder how many executive orders he's going to write or unleash on immigration reform if legislative efforts stall in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Let's go through a couple of the major components of these principles that they've laid out. Number one, and this is, I think, number one in people's mind, is the idea of securing the border. I don't know how many times we need to say this or how many years we actually have to talk about this. In my opinion, we could secure the border in a week if we really wanted to. It's not that difficult. It's not rocket science. We've got the tools. We've got the people to be able to do it. If we were really serious about it, we could do it in a week. Your take on that?
Yeah, well, that's what's real interesting about this bill. It tried to, please both parties by offering a pathway to citizenship, which pleased the Democrats, and then offering, you know, to stiffen the border, increase border enforcement by and doing that to please the Republicans. And I think the sticking point is going to be Republicans are going to insist that we secure the border first and then do the pathway to citizenship second. Meanwhile, I don't think Democrats are going to go for that. They're going to want to do the pathway to citizenship first, or at the best case scenario for conservative perspective, to do both at the same time. What's really frustrating to a lot of conservative lawmakers here is that, you know, all this talk of immigration reform, they feel like that there are plenty of laws on the book now that offer a secure border and do the things that need to be done, but they're just not being enforced and not being implemented and understaffed and along the border with Border Patrol agents. And they wonder you know, what is more legalese, what's more legislation, what are more words on a paper going to do to change that? It's, to a lot of conservative lawmakers here, it's not so much new laws, but let's enforce our existing laws.
Mm-hmm. The second thing that, and you mentioned it a few times here, is the idea of accountability. I'm sorry, the path to citizenship. The third thing, though, is the idea of accountability. The idea that of e-verify, you know, some way of verifying whether a person is legal or not, so that businesses will not be hiring those who are illegal. That just seems to make sense. So we've got secure the border, some sort of a path to citizenship, this accountability with e-verify, and then what sort of benefits do these people, there's 11 million that are here, what sort of benefits do they get while they're, all of this is taking place? There's a lot of talk now about if they're added to the Obamacare rolls, this will just destroy, I mean, it'll just bankrupt the entire system to put 11 million new people onto those rolls. So all four of those things need to be considered, right?
Yeah, it's definitely a complex mix of issues, and I know that a lot of the details have yet to be drafted, but one thing they did talk about in their outline when they introduced it on Monday was that once these illegal immigrants come out and kind of identify themselves and register with the government, they'll have to pay a fine, number one, and then number two, they'll be allowed to keep working under a probationary legal status. And the question, you know, arises among conservative lawmakers is how many illegal immigrants are going to voluntarily, you know, and identify themselves and then on top of that pay a fine. So there's a lot of questions about how that'll be enforced and implemented. And as you mentioned, all of the lists that you came up with, it's just any time you deal with immigration reform, it's not just one or two things, it's the whole pot full of things. And that's why it's been unsuccessfully reformed over the last, you know, two decades or so. I guess the last reform was back in the Reagan era, and some conservatives would argue if that was a reform at all back in 1986. And the last time Congress made a sincere effort at doing things was 2007. And here we are back again, you know, 6 years later, back to square one. So who knows what kind of quote-unquote solutions this Congress will come up with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the conservatives involved in this, specifically Marco Rubio taking the lead as the champion of it, he's got his work cut out for him from two standpoints. One, the conservatives have already started to, on a lot of the social media sites, have termed it scamnacy. So, you know, they remember when our own senator here, Lindsey Graham, tried to do this. They called it Grahamnesty. So now they've renamed it as well. So initially they weren't on board. Maybe that'll change when they hear him articulate a little bit more of what's taking place. The second thing that's a real problem here is the way that the president treats those on the other side of these issues, where the president is going to continue to demonize the conservatives as being uncaring and ruthless and racist and all of these types of things. And he's got to be very careful not to be used as a pawn in the hand of the president, you know, where he'll just allow him to accomplish so many things and then basically demonize him and the rest of the conservatives as well in the end. And that's a very tricky thing to do because he's a very good politician, and that's not a compliment. So, Lee, thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's something that, you know, former Vice President Cannon and Congressman Paul Ryan was warning at a speech he gave this weekend in Washington. He was just saying that the Republicans cannot allow themselves to be the, quote, the villain in Obama's morality plays, and that's something that he feels like, you know, Obama's been successful in doing over the last couple of years is kind of, you know, setting up the Republicans to be the villains and baiting the Republicans and portraying them as cruel and unyielding. And, you know, just the other day, you know, he said Republicans had suspicions about Social Security and that they had suspicions about feeding hungry children. He, as Ryan said, quote, it's the same trick he plays every time, fight a straw man, avoid honest debate, win the argument by default, is what Ryan said in the speech on Saturday.
Yes.
We can't get rattled, Ryan said. We won't play the villain in his morality play. We have to stay united.
Exactly. And the Republicans have historically, and especially in modern history, they've been absolutely terrible at this. They are always behind. They don't articulate their points very well. They always come across as more what they're against than what they're for. A lot of what Jindal had spoken the other day, I think, is a good snapshot of where they're currently at. And if that doesn't change, and maybe it will with someone like a Rubio being able to articulate a little bit better, but if that doesn't change, then they're in big trouble. So I hope that this is a sign of change. Lee, thank you very much for joining us today and for your insight there on what's taking place in Washington, D.C. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. I hope we got better coverage on myself. There's a lot of clouds here in D.C. I think we're going to have an odd summer-like thunderstorm in late January, so I hope that you were able to hear me.
Yes, we could. We understand. We've got some bad weather in this area as well. Even in Oconee County this morning, they were had a tornado watch, and so a lot of stormy weather in the area. But it was just fine. Thank you, Lee. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I look forward to being on the show again.
Okay. That was Edward Lee Pitts. He's the Washington Bureau Chief there for World Magazine. You can read his articles out on worldmag.com. That's www.worldmag.com. When we come back from the break, excuse me, I want you to hear a little bit from Breakpoint and a conversation that the host of the program there, John Stone Street, did with an author called Sherry Turkle. She wrote a book called Alone Together, How Technology is Changing Our Relationships. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
Does the health of your body say anything about the health of your soul? Is it possible that a wounded spirit is responsible for pain in the body? Well, what do you think? Is it possible that body and soul are tied together? Well, Lane Arnold, author of the book, Life of the Body, thinks so, and she wants to share her thoughts with you this Friday at 11:30 here on Christian Talk 660, 92.9 FM on Peace Talk, your place to find hope, get help, discover peace.
Since the revolution of the 1960s, the moral revolution, we have two nations of people trying to live side by side with radically opposing sets of values and belief systems. The Apostle Paul tells us we're not wrestling against flesh and blood, but against powers and forces and spiritual wickedness in high places. It's a spiritual battle that requires spiritual arms and equipment to be engaged in. In a few months, we're going to be gathering together thousands of Christians in Orlando. And the title of this coming conference is No Compromise. And we have a marvelous cast of speakers assembled for this event. We have Sinclair Ferguson, we have Dr. Bob Godfrey, we have Steve Lawson, R.C. Sproul Jr., Alistair Begg, and Ravi Zacharias, and even Cal Thomas. And so I urge you to come and stand with us and stand together, bearing witness to the kingdom of God.
Ever feel like there has to be a better way to manage your finances? Focus on the Family is proud to partner with Crown Money Life Coaching, the only award-winning online solution that effectively implements envelope budgeting for today's cashless world and provides you with a personal coach. And now you can get your first coaching session free of charge. That's right, it's completely free. Call Crown Money Life Coaching at 800-215-3147 to get started. Join thousands who are achieving financial success. That's 800-215-3147.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back into the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast today. Before we get started on the topic that I wanted to go to in the second half, let me just take care of a couple of items. One, first of all, I wanted to wish a happy birthday to Dr. Jay Adams. It's his birthday today, and he's 84 years old. Of course, some would say probably the founder and the father of the nouthetic counseling movement in this country. And so he's 84 years old, lives right here in the upstate of South Carolina. Happy birthday, Dr. Adams. I had the privilege of sitting through some biblical counseling training courses where Dr. Adams was the instructor. Both myself and my wife sat through some of those courses and learned that process there, nouthetic counseling, and was just such a privilege to be able to do it with Dr. Adams himself. He's really got a great mind and really has been his work has been a tremendous blessing to evangelical Christianity for many, many years. Also, let me just very quickly mention that we started a brand new sermon series at the church that I pastor in Traveler's Rest. If you're looking for a church home, we're covering right now the book of Hebrews. And so we're looking at the superiority of Christ, that Christ is superior to all that has come before him. Let me go ahead and just leave it at that. But if you want to shoot me an email, kevin@knowingthetruth.org, I'd be happy to give you directions about how to come to the church and worship with us as we go through each Sunday. We're about 2 weeks in and still in the first chapter, just looking at the second half of the first chapter, verses 6 down to verse 14 will be our subject this particular week as we look at Christ being better than the angels. And so if you're interested in it, that it's going to be a protracted study, just shoot me an email. I'll give you directions to the church, kevin@knowingthetruth.org. Okay, let's listen to this segment with Breakpoint. We'll let John Stone Street do the interview here for the rest of the broadcast, but a very interesting interview with Sherry Turkle. She's the author of a book called Alone Together, and it's how technology is changing our relationship and how we, our relationships, I should say, and how we can respond to that. Listen in.
We've talked here in the past about how technology shapes us, and today I'm just very honored and pleased to have with us someone who has written extensively on this issue. She really is probably the world expert on how computers and internet life reshape our understanding of ourselves. Dr. Sherry Turkle is a professor of social studies of science and technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She's the author of three very important books, which I encountered the first two when I was in grad school and eagerly awaited the next one, which did not come until 2011, a terrific book called Alone Together. And the shift in thinking and her predictions in these three books are things that we need to pay attention to. And so that's going to be our topic here today. Dr. Turkle, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Breakpoint this week. I want to just begin by asking you a question here. Your interest in kind of a psychoanalysis of technology and computer technology came early in the game. I mean, the first book that you wrote, The Second Self, was published in 1984. I mean, that's before Al Gore invented the internet for us, right? I mean, that's a long time ago. I mean, at that point, computers were basically calculators. What made you start thinking along these lines?
Well, I was very, very fortunate in that, really by accident, I took a job as an assistant professor at MIT, not particularly to study computers and people, but I was in a position to see some of the first people who were interacting with those early personal computers at a time when people would say to me, oh, the computer is just a tool. The computer is just a tool. People will use it to do taxes. I mean, people didn't know what they could use it for. And yet I saw people had a kind of passionate relationship with a computer that they could put on their desk, that they could own, that they almost used to think about their minds. You know, kids had a natural affinity for them. They loved to program them. They loved to play games on them. So I began to see that they even thought of the computer, I called it a second self. They thought of their minds as machines. People talked about whether their minds were programmed. All in all, to put it, you know, just very briefly, I really had a very early look by being at MIT in the late 1970s, at the fact that the computer wasn't just a machine, that the computer was a very special kind of machine that we should study from a psychological point of view. So it was really a kind of, you know, combination of luck and being one of the few psychologists who was there to see that early kind of passionate relationship that people had with this object.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting to me about your work is the predictions that you've made. So in the second self, as we just said, you started to see, wait a minute, people are seeing the computer as more than a tool. They're seeing it as part of their life. In your second book, Life on the Screen, you take that a little bit further, and you actually talk about computer life being a place where one could explore alternate identities and where the self could be kind of rethought and remade. And, of course, we've seen that. I mean, you wrote that book before Facebook. And, of course, the social media and social networking tools that we have today, they're essentially identity tools. They're ways to be who we want to be so that people can see us. And at that point, you were pretty positive about the experience. You thought it was a pretty good thing.
Yes, I did. I really saw people going online, and because when they were online, they could experiment in ways that they couldn't experiment in the rest of their life. You know, the shy could become more adventurous. People experimented with gender. People, you know, men would pretend to be women, not just for sort of the experience of having a sexual sort of experience, but really to see, as many of them said, what it was like to be continually interrupted in a conversation. You know, you'd have men say, my God, if you go online as a woman, people don't let you finish a sentence. You know, if you go online as a woman, people keep coming on to you. So, you know, people had experiences of all sorts that I thought were very interesting, that my hope was that, and what I saw, it wasn't just really a hope, that people used what they learned online to improve the quality of life in the rest of their life. And so I actually was quite optimistic. But then some things changed, and I'm an honest anthropologist, I'm an honest psychologist, and I began to strike a more cautionary note in the mid-90s.
I think the first book of yours that I read was Life on the Screen, and I, coming from a faith perspective and certainly an understanding of gender and sexuality, some of the things that you were happy with, I was much more concerned about, but your analysis was just dead on. It was just so fascinating. And then, you know, your book that was published in 2011, Alone Together, the title really says it all, which is essentially we have more means of connecting, more means of communicating, more means of relating to other people, but we're not doing it. We're worse at relationships. In fact, the subtitle, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. And I thought, wow, what a striking analysis. And I want you to talk a little bit about what are some of those things then that started to give you pause about how people were approaching relationships and what you were seeing in terms of relational skills from, you know, I guess we could call it the natives, you know, especially the younger kids who grew up not knowing anything but the Internet, not knowing anything but social media.
Well, I can talk about, you know, the things that changed my mind since I had been so positive. The biggest thing that changed my mind was that when I had been so positive, I had a model of how people were going to use this technology that involved, you know, they'd be sitting at a computer and they would have these experiences online that would be, you know, which they would learn about themselves. And then they would get up from the computer and they would use these experiences in which they learned about themselves, as I said before, to live better lives in the real. And then they would sit down at the computer again and they would have other experiences at the computer, and then they would get up and they would live better lives in the real. And what changed that I hadn't seen, I was not prescient, was that with mobile technology, we would be constantly going in and out of our computer lives and paying less and less full attention to what was happening in our real life. So I go out to dinner with friends, and it's not an unusual experience for people to be constantly checking their text messages. I just finished teaching a class in which you can see students struggling to not check their text messages. And that's because it's a small seminar and, you know, they kind of can't. But I stand in the back of large lecture halls and, you know, students are texting and doing and going on Facebook. People text in church. I study this. And you ask them why, and they sort of say, I can't not. And that's where the title of my book, Alone Together, comes, is that people want to be with each other and present to each other, but they also want to use the technology to be elsewhere, sort of wherever else they want to be. It's very hard for people to give their full attention to whatever it is that they're doing. So you go to a playground and you see parents who are basically not watching their kids on the swing sets because they're on their phones. You watch mothers nursing and they're on their phones. You watch mothers and fathers pushing strollers and they're on their phones. And it's very hard for us now to give our full attention to where we are at with other people. And I think this is really where we are not doing each other justice. We're not doing ourselves justice because we're having fewer conversations and more connection. And connection and conversation are not the same thing. And that's what I've found in my field work. And that's the perspective I take in the book.
We're talking about how technology affects our understanding of ourselves with renowned author of Alone Together, Sherry Turkle, here on Breakpoint this week. Connection is not the same thing as it used to be. That's such an interesting way of saying it. One of the things that you bring up there that I thought was really powerful, and of course, you know, as you said, one of the contexts where we see this most, I think, drastically is in the context of the family. But what it does is it really kind of wears down our relational skill set. And yeah, I didn't want to jump to this too soon because sometimes the predictions that you've made in your books, you know, probably in the 1980s, you know, the predictions that you made in The Second Self, you know, sounded a little crazy. And the predictions you made in the 1990s in Life on the Screen sounded a little crazy. Well, the prediction that you make in Alone Together kind of sounds a little crazy, but you're 2 for 2 so far. So I think you're on a pretty good pace. But the prediction you make is that we've actually become people, and we're going to continue to become people that will choose artificial or maybe what we would say is digital or electronic relationships rather than real ones because our relational skill set will be so poor. All we'll want out of relationships is empathy. We'll just want someone to acknowledge our feelings and our emotions, but we don't want anything to be required of us. And you make that prediction in terms of companion robots, and certainly at MIT you probably see some of this technology that's going to bring some of these predictions to life. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, do you really see that in the human future where we're really going to have trouble relating to actual human beings because they kind of ask too much of us?
I mean, I think we're at a choice point. So I don't want to say that's so much my prediction, but I think that we're on a path where over and over I hear people say, I'd rather text than talk. You know, I do interviews and I do a lot of my own transcription so I can hear, you know, the voices that I've, you know, the people I've interviewed. And there's no phrase that I heard more than I'd rather text than talk. And what people are basically saying is that it's easier to text than it is to have a face-to-face conversation. Face-to-face conversation is hard. You know, an apology is hard. People keep talking about how hard it is to really apologize and how easy it is to type, I'm sorry, and hit send. To really apologize, you have to let somebody see that you see that you've hurt them and really think about how you're going to make amends. And that's very different than just typing, I'm sorry, and hitting send. And, you know, to really have a conversation, you have to open yourself up and really listen. And many people just feel now that they're busy, that they're stressed. They just want to not have all that trouble. And what they want from relationships, quote, is just something more sort of superficial and something where they get information, they get some support, a much more behaviorally oriented, superficial kind of connection. And I talk about robots because there's a whole industry that's poised to give you robots to take care of children, robots to take care of the elderly. And this is not science fiction. I mean, this is actually happening. It's in its early stages now, but there is an industry gearing up to present the culture with companionate machines that will offer you these options, a kind of company that that requires really nothing of you relationally. And if we really just want sort of a kind of superficial company, people may well choose to have that kind of superficial company. I see my work as not saying, you know, watch out, you know, you're going to just get a robot, but saying, you know, hey, you know, what does it mean that people say, I really just would rather not talk to people face to face? And I don't hear that a little. I hear that a lot. I'm not predicting a robotic future. I'm saying that we have a choice and that we have a technology that is putting us in the mood to not call each other. We're having a conversation on the radio where we can respond to each other. We can hear each other's voice. You can respond to my inflection. You can sort of tell if the possibilities that I'm describing upset me. Clearly they do. If we were doing this by texting each other, this would be a very different kind of conversation. And yet these are the sorts of conversations that people are choosing to have instead of hearing each other's voices. And the reason they're choosing to have those conversations, when I ask them, what's wrong with having a conversation? People say, I'll tell you what's wrong with having a conversation. You don't know where it's going to go, and you can't sort of edit it as you go along and come across exactly the way you want to come across. And that's what people like about texting, and that's what people like about email, is that feeling of control. And, you know, I think we're getting used to projecting ourselves, whether it's a Facebook profile or an email or in a text, that feeling of being able to edit and control. And by putting that value first, I think we're shortchanging ourselves. And sometimes the danger is that we'll forget what a real conversation is.
Dr. Tuchel, you're reminding me of a passage in C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man, where he talks about, you know, man's attempt to control nature eventually has to become certain men's attempt to control other men and make them what they want. And obviously he would never have foreseen every man's attempt to control their own little corner of nature so that they wouldn't have to have real conversations. But we see this. I mean, we see this in families. I talk to kids all the time and I say, how many of you have ever broken off a relationship through text messaging? And, you know, most of them have. It's a stunning thing. I remember seeing the TED Talk that you gave on the book, Dr. Tuchel, which was a terrific presentation. We'll link to it at breakpoint.org. But you mentioned, you know, that some of your concerns came out of conversations or the realities you were seeing even with your own teenage daughter. You're dealing with this as a mom or, you know, on a family level, not just as a professional.
You know, I think if you have children, you have to start to say dinner, breakfast, no texting. These are sacred spaces in your home where it's time for conversation. And I tell parents, I think the best advice I give to the parents is that the car is a sacred space. And they look at me and they say, the car? And I say, absolutely. In the car, you need to be able to overhear what your kids are talking about. You know, you can't have them texting in the back of the car, silent. You need to overhear their conversations and you need them talking to you. That school ride, you know, that ride to school in the morning and back, that's precious time. You can't give that up to their texting. And then family vacations, you know, when people made up those crazy games, those are the most important memories the families have together. You can't have everybody in the car, you know, texting people who aren't there. These are times I really talk about sacred spaces. I feel very strongly about this, that you need to have in your family sacred space for conversation, and it should be the kitchen, the dining room, the car. And for most families, it's easier to talk about spaces than it is about time. For most families, it's very hard to say, you know, it's 5 to 6 or it's 6 to 9. Or it's, most families, it's easier to say these are the places in our home where when we come into these places, you know, we don't bring our phone. When we're in the kitchen together, we don't bring our phone.
Well, there you have it. That was an interview that was done by John Stonestreet. John is with Breakpoint. You remember that was the news commentary that was done by Chuck Colson. Well, that's now been, of course, when Chuck Colson went home to be with the Lord, that others have gotten involved in that now, and John Stonestreet is one of them. And he was doing this interview as part of their program. By the way, their program is heard right here on Christian Talk 660 on Sundays at 1:30 p.m. So you can listen to other interviews that they do at that time as well. And this was from their one of their most recent ones. I think it was put out on the 26th, was it, I think. And so anyways, on their website, and their website is www.breakpoint.org. But John was speaking with Sherry Turkle, and she's the author of Alone Together, about how technology is changing our relationships and how we should respond. I think that they made some excellent points there, that we need to look at every aspect of our life and look at it from a biblical perspective to decide whether or not it is good or bad, whether it can be is being used for the glory of God. There are many good things that are being done with technology. Right now I'm speaking into a microphone, and it's going, that's a 50,000-watt station. It's going out in over the airwaves in four states, and also it's going to be on the Internet on sermonaudio.com, and I'll have people download this broadcast from China later on this week. And so this is tremendous, you know, and what a blessing. But is it all upside, or is there some downside to this technology? And what we're learning is there is some downside as well. And the downside seems to be in the area of relationships and learning how to have a relationship with other people. I mentioned to you one time about an experience that I had a couple years ago where I was with somebody, and another person came up to us. And the person I was with, although he had never actually met the other person in person, immediately said, hey, he introduced his name, and he said, I'm your friend. I'm your friend on Facebook. So here was this bizarre experience of somebody who is, quote, unquote, a friend with somebody, and yet they have never actually met in person. So it just began to make me wonder about technology and about where we're going. I thought she pointed out Sherry Turkle in her comments here, and as far as I know, she doesn't claim to be a believer. It didn't sound like that in her interview with John Stone Street. But she was saying in her statements that one of the things that she was recommending was carving out some sacred space. I think that that's very good advice. I don't like this whole idea of people texting in church. I think that church is a sacred space. I think that when we come into the service, it's meant for you to be there to be worshiping God, not to be tweeting out to your friends, you know, a certain point in the sermon even. There's a time for these things, and she pointed out a number of other times in our family. Deuteronomy chapter 6 was coming to mind, where it talks about as we walk with our children, speak with them as they lie down, as they get up, and so forth. We've got to be all there. You know, that was a statement that was made by the great missionary Jim Elliot. He said, you know, whatever you're involved in, be all there. And what we're finding today with technology is people often aren't all there. They're not all there when they're driving. We see this. I've had the experience the last couple of weeks where I've seen people weaving all over the road, and I was wondering what was going on, only to find out when I drove up alongside at a red light that the person was on the phone texting. So they're not all there. So we find churches that people are not all there in the service because they're involved in social media while the service is going on, and some churches are even encouraging this. And then we find in families that people are not all there in the family because everybody is on a different communication source and sending out things to others who aren't even in the room with them. I think all of that is a problem, and I think all of that needs to be looked at from a more biblical perspective. We should be all there in whatever we're involved in. Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. This idea of multitasking is overrated. We need to concentrate on what we're doing, think and think deeply about the things of God. Remember this. Jesus said, thou shalt know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We'll see you next time right here on Knowing the Truth.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life and Liberty Radio, Christian Talk 660, WLFJ Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson on AM 660, and also on FM 92.9.